and Hunter promised himself he would remember it. Chapter 26. 3 days later, they sighted the monster. It had been an uneventful sail down the chain of the Lesser Antilles. The wind was fair and the sea calm. Hunter knew he was now nearly 100 miles south of Matanceros, and with each passing hour, he breathed more easily. His crew was busy making the galleon as seaworthy as possible. The Spanish crew had kept El Trinidad in a lamentable state of repair. Rigging was frayed, sails were thin in places, torn in others. Decks were filthy and the hold stank with refuse. There was much to do as they sailed southward, past Guadeloupe and San Marino. On noon of the third day, Enders, ever watchful, noticed the change in the water. He pointed off to starboard. "Look there," he said to Hunter. Hunter turned. The water was placid, with only a slight chop to mar the glassy surface. But barely 100 yards away, there was a churning beneath the waves. Some large object moving toward them, and at incredible speed. "What are we making?" he demanded. 10 knots, Enders said. "Mother of God!" "If we are making 10, that thing is making 20, Hunter said. "At least 20, Enders said. He glanced around at the crews. No one had noticed it. "Move to landward," Hunter said. "Get us in shoal water." "The Kraken don't like it shallow," Enders said. "Let us hope not." The submerged shape moved closer and passed by the boat some 50 yards away. Hunter had a glimpse of dead gray white, a suggestion of tentacles, and then the thing was gone. It moved off and circled, then came back again. Enders slapped his cheek. "I'm dreaming," he said. "I must be. Say it is not true." "It's true," Hunter said. From the nest of the mainmast, Lazoo, the lookout, whistled to Hunter. She had seen the thing. Hunter looked up at her and shook his head to keep silent. "Thank God she didn't give out the cry," Enders said. "That's all we'd be needing, isn't it?" "Shoal water," Hunter said grimly, and quickly. He watched the churning water approach once more. Up in the mainmast nest, Lazoo was high above the clear blue water, and she could see the approach of the Kraken plainly. Her heart was in her throat, for this was a legendary beast, the stuff of sailing songs and stories for the children of seafarers. But few had ever seen such a creature, and Lazoo was not glad of the experience. It seemed to her that her heart stopped as she watched the thing approach again with frightening speed, plowing up the surface as it came toward the El Trinidad. When it was very close, she saw the entire animal clearly. Its skin was a dead gray. It had a pointed snout, a bulbous body at least 20 feet long, and trailing behind a tangle of long tentacles, like a Medusa's head. It passed beneath the ship, not touching the hull, but the waves from the creature's movements rocked the galleon. Then she saw it emerge on the other side and plunge down into the blue depths of the ocean. She wiped her sweating brow. Lady Sarah Almont came on deck to find Hunter peering over the side. "Good day, Captain," she said. He turned and gave her a slight bow. "Madam?"
"Captain, you are quite ashen. Is all well?"
Without replying, Hunter rushed to the other side of the aft deck and peered over the side again. Enders at the tiller said, "You see it?"
"See what?"
asked Lady Sarah. "No," Hunter said. "It dived."
"We should have 30 fathoms beneath us," Enders said. "That's shoal for the thing."
"What thing?"
asked Lady Sarah, pouting prettily. Hunter came back to her. Enders said, "It may be back." "Aye," Hunter said. She looked from Hunter to Enders. Both men were drenched in cold sweat. Both were very pale.
"Captain, I am no sailor. What is the meaning of this?"
Enders, tense, exploded.
"God's blood, woman! We have just seen—"
"An omen," said Hunter smoothly, with a sharp look to Enders. "An omen, my lady."
"An omen? Are you superstitious, Captain?"
"Aye, he's very superstitious, he is," said Enders, glancing out toward the horizon.
"It is plain," said Lady Sarah, stamping her foot on the deck, "that you will not tell me what is amiss."
"That's right," Hunter said, smiling. He had a charming smile, even through his pallor. He could be most exasperating, she thought.
"I know I am a woman," she began, "but I really must insist."
And at that moment, Lazoo shouted,
"Sail ho!"
Straining his eyes to the glass, Hunter saw square canvas directly astern, coming above the line of the horizon. He turned back to Enders, but the sea artist was already barking orders to run out all the canvas El Trinidad possessed. The top gallants were unreefed, the foresprit was run up, and the galleon gathered speed. A warning shot was fired to the Cassandra, a quarter of a mile ahead. Soon after, the little sloop also let out her full canvas. Hunter looked through the glass again. The sails on the horizon had not grown larger, but neither had they diminished in size.
"God's blood, from one monster to another," Enders said. "How do we fare?"
"We're holding," Hunter said.
"We must come off this course soon," Enders said.
Hunter nodded. El Trinidad was running free before an easterly wind, but her course carried her too far west, toward the island chain to their right. Soon the water would be too shallow. They would have to alter course. On any ship, a course change meant at least a temporary loss in speed. Short-handed, the galleon would be especially slow. Hunter said, "Can you wear her?" Enders shook his head.
"I dare not, Captain. We are too short-manned."
Lady Sarah said,
"What is the problem?"
"Quiet," Hunter said. "Go below."
"I will not—"
"Go below," he bellowed. She backed off, but did not go below. Standing some distance away, she watched what she viewed as a strange spectacle. The man Lazoo came down from the rigging with cat-like grace, almost feminine in his movements. It was with a shock that Lady Sarah noticed the press of the wind against Lazoo's blouse, clearly outlining breasts. So the gentle man was a woman. She had no time to ponder this, however, for Hunter was standing with Lazoo and Enders, and all were engaged in fierce conversation. Hunter showed her the pursuing ship and the island chain to the right. He pointed to the cloudless sky and the sun, already on its downward arc as afternoon wore on. Lazoo was frowning.
"What island will you make for?" she said.
"Cat," Enders said, pointing to a large island down the chain.
"Monkey Bay?" she asked.
"Aye," Enders said, "Monkey Bay." "Do you know it?" Hunter said.
"Yes, but it was years past, and this is a windward port. How is the moon?"
"Third quarter," Hunter said.
"And there are no clouds," Lazoo said. "Pity."
At this, they all nodded and shook their heads very gloomily. Then Lazoo said,
"Are you a gambler?"
"You know I am," Hunter said.
"Then make your course change, and see if you can outrun the ship. If you do, well and good. If not, we will manage."
"I trust your eyes," Hunter said.
"Do,"
Lazoo said, and she scrambled back up the rigging to her lookout post. Lady Sarah could make nothing of this conversation, although she recognized the tension and concern well enough. She remained by the railing, looking toward the horizon, where the sails of the pursuing ship were now clearly visible to her naked eye, until Hunter came over to her. Now that the decision was made, he seemed more relaxed.
"I did not understand a word of that," she said.
"It is simple enough," Hunter said. "You see the ship following?"
"I do."
"And you see the island downwind, Cat Island?"
"I do."
"There is a harbor there, called Monkey Bay. It is our first refuge, if we can make it." She looked from the pursuing ship to the island.
"But surely you are close to the island, and there will be no problem."
"You see the sun?"
"Yes."
"The sun is setting to the west. In another hour, it will gleam off the water with a brightness to cause pain to the eye, and we cannot see the obstructions beneath as we make for that bay. In these waters,
A ship cannot sail into the sun unless you risk tearing out the bottom on coral.
But Lazoo has entered the port before.
Aye, but it is a windward port. Windward ports are exposed to the storms and strong currents of the open ocean, and they change. A sandbar can shift in days, weeks. Monkey Bay may not be as Lazoo remembers it.
Oh.
She was silent a moment.
Then why make for port?
You have not stopped these 3 nights past. Sail on into the night, and lose the ship in darkness. She felt very pleased with this solution.
There is a moon, Hunter said gloomily. Third quarter. It will not be up until midnight.
But it will be up enough for the ship to follow us. We will have only 4 hours of true darkness. We cannot lose her in so short a time.
Then what will you do?
Hunter picked up the glass and scanned the horizon. The pursuing ship was slowly gaining on them.
I will make for Monkey Bay, into the sun.
Ready about!
Enders shouted, and the ship came around into the wind, slowly, cumbersomely changing course. It took a full quarter of an hour before they were cutting through the water again, and during that interval, the sails of the pursuing craft had grown much larger. As Hunter peered through the glass, he felt something about those sails was depressingly familiar.
You don't suppose...
What, sir?
Lazoo, Hunter shouted, and pointed to the horizon. Up above, Lazoo put the glass to her eye.
What do you make it to be?
She shouted down.
Our old friend!
Enders groaned.
Kazala's warship? The Black Ship?
None other.
Who commands her now? Enders said.
Bosquet, the Frenchy, Hunter said, recalling the slim, composed man he had seen board the ship at Montanceros.
I know of him, Enders said. Steady and competent seaman. He knows his trade.
He sighed.
Too bad it's not a Don at the helm. We might have better luck.
The Spaniards were notoriously bad seamen. How long to landfall now?
A full hour, Enders said. Could be more. If the passage is tight, we've got to get in some of this canvas.
That would cut their speed even more, but it could not be helped. If they were to have control over the ship in confined waters, they would have to shorten sail. Hunter looked back at the pursuing warship. She was changing course, her sails tilting as she wore to leeward. She lost ground a moment, but soon was moving ahead at full speed.
It will be a very near thing, he said.
Aye, Enders said.
Lazoo, up in the rigging, stretched her left arm. Enders changed course, watching until she dropped her arm. Then he held steady. A short time later, her right arm was held out, half bent. Enders again corrected course, turning slightly to starboard.
Part 4. Monkey Bay. Chapter 27. El Trinidad made for the cove of Monkey Bay. Aboard the Cassandra, Sanson watched the larger ship maneuver.
Blood of Louis! They're making for land, he said. Into the sun!
It is madness, moaned the man at the helm.
Now hear me,
Sanson said, spinning on him.
Come about, and fall into the wake of that Danish hag, and follow it exactly. I mean none else. Exactly. Our bows must cut their form, or I will cut your throat.
How can they do it? Into the sun, moaned the helmsman.
They have Lazoo's eyes, Sanson said. It may be enough.
Lazoo was careful where she looked. She was also careful what she did with her arms, for the most casual gesture would cause a course change. At this moment, she stared westward, holding her left hand flat under her nose, blocking the reflection of the sun off the water just ahead of the bow. She looked only to the land, the sloping green contours of Cat Island. At this moment, a flat outline, without depth. She knew that somewhere ahead, when they were closer, the island contour would begin to separate, to show definition, and she would see the entrance to Monkey Bay. Until that moment, her job was to hold the fastest course bearing on the point where she expected to find the entrance. Her elevation helped her. From this vantage point atop the mainmast, she was able to see the color of the water many miles ahead, an intricate pattern of blues and greens of different intensities. In her mind, these registered as depths. She could read them as if they were a chart marked with soundings. This was no mean skill. The ordinary seaman, knowing the clarity of Caribbean water, naturally assumed that deep blue meant deep water and green still deeper. Lazoo knew better. If the bottom was sandy, the water might be light blue, though the depth was 50 feet. Or a deep green color could mean a seagrass bottom just 10 feet deep. And the shifting sun over the course of the day played odd tricks. In early morning or late afternoon, all the colors were richer and darker. One had to compensate. But for the moment, she had no concern for depth. She scanned the colors at the shoreline, looking for some clue to the entrance to Monkey Bay. She remembered that Monkey Bay was the outflow of a small river of fresh water, as was the case with most usable coves. There were many other Caribbean coves that were not safe for large ships because there was no gap in the offshore coral reef. To have a gap, one needed a fresh water outflow, for where there was fresh water, coral did not grow. Lazoo, scanning the water near the shoreline, knew that the gap might not be near the stream itself. Depending on the currents that carried the fresh water out to sea, the actual break in the reef might be a quarter mile north or south. Wherever it was, currents often produced a brownish turbidity in the water and a change in the surface appearance. She scanned carefully, and finally she saw it, south of the ship's present course. She signaled corrections to Enders on the deck below. As El Trinidad came closer, she was glad that the sea artist had no idea what he was facing. He would faint if he knew how narrow the gap in the reef really was. There were coral heads awash on both sides, and between them the open space was no more than a dozen yards. Satisfied with the new course, Lazoo closed her eyes for several minutes. She was aware of the pink color of sunlight on her eyelids. She was not aware of the motion of the ship, or the wind in the sails, or the smells of the ocean. She was focused entirely on her eyes as she rested them. Nothing mattered but her eyes. She breathed deeply and slowly, preparing herself for the coming exertion, gathering her energy, sharpening her concentration. She knew how it would happen. She knew the inevitable progression. An easy beginning and then the first ache in her eyes, the increasing pain, then tears, stinging, burning. At the end of the hour, she knew she would be wholly exhausted, her entire body limp. She would need sleep as if she had been awake for a week, and would probably collapse as soon as she climbed down to the deck. It was for this coming massive exertion that she prepared herself now, breathing in long, slow breaths, with her eyes closed. For Enders, at the helm, his concentration was very different. His eyes were open, but he had little interest in what he saw. Enders felt the tiller in his hands, the pressure it exerted on his palms, the cant of the deck beneath his feet, the rumble of the water slipping by the hull, the wind on his cheeks, the vibration of the rigging, the whole complex of forces and stresses that made up the trim of the ship. Indeed, in his absolute concentration, Enders became part of the ship, joined to it as if physically connected. He was the brain to its body, and he knew its condition to the minutest detail. He knew its speed to a fraction of a knot. He sensed when any sail was wrongly trimmed. He knew when any cargo shifted in the hold, and he knew where. He felt how much water was in the bilge. He knew when the ship was sailing easy, when she was on her best line. He knew when she was past it, and how long she could hold past it, and how far he could push her. All this he could have told you with his eyes closed. He could not have said how he knew it, only that he did. Now, working with Lazoo, he was worried, precisely because he had to give over part of his control to someone else. Lazoo's hand signals meant nothing to him that he could sense directly. Yet he followed her directions blindly, knowing that he must trust her. But he was nervous about it. He sweated at the tiller, feeling the wind more strongly on his damp cheeks, and he made more corrections as Lazoo stretched out her arms. She was taking the ship southward. She must have spotted the break in the reef, he thought, and was now making for it. Soon they would pass through the gap. The very idea made him sweat more. Hunter's mind was wholly occupied with other concerns. He raced back and forth from bow to stern, ignoring both Lazoo and Enders. The Spanish warship was closing with each passing minute. The upper edge of the mainsail was now clear of the horizon. She still carried full sail, while El Trinidad, now only a mile off the island, had dropped much of her canvas. Meanwhile, the Cassandra had fallen behind the larger ship, dropping back to port to let Hunter's vessel show them the course to harbor. The maneuver was necessary, but Hunter's canvas was eating Cassandra's wind, and the little ship was not making good speed. Indeed, she would not until she was completely astern of El Trinidad. At that point, she would be very vulnerable to the Spanish warship unless she stayed close to Hunter. The trouble would come when making the bay itself. The two ships would have to pass through in close succession. If El Trinidad did not make passage smoothly, the Cassandra might ram her, injuring both ships. If it happened in the passage itself, it could be a nightmare, both ships sinking on the rocks of the reef. He was sure Sanson was aware of the danger. He was equally sure that Sanson would know that he dared not drop too far back. It was going to be a very tricky maneuver. He ran forward and stared through the shimmering glare of the sunlit water at Monkey Bay. He could now see the curving finger of hilly land extending out from the island and forming the protected hook of the bay. The actual gap in the reef was invisible to him. It lay somewhere in the sheet of glaring, sparkling water directly ahead. He looked up the mainmast to Lazoo and saw her make a signal to Enders. She swung her fist upward to strike the flat palm of her hand. Enders immediately barked orders to lower more sail. Hunter knew that could only mean one thing. They were very close to the reef passage. He squinted forward into the glare, but still could see nothing. "Linemen, starboard and larboard!" shouted Enders, and soon after, two men on either side of the bow began to alternate shouted soundings. The first unnerved Hunter. "Full five!" 5 fathoms, 30 feet, was already shallow water. El Trinidad drew 3 fathoms, so there was not much to spare. In shoal waters, coral undersea outcroppings could easily rise 12 feet from the bottom in irregular patterns, and the sharp coral would tear the wooden hull like paper. "Cinq et demi!" came the next cry. That was better. Hunter waited. "Full 6 and more!" He breathed a little easier. They must have passed the outer reef. Most islands had 2, a shallow inner reef and a deeper one offshore. They would have a short space of safe water now before they reached the dangerous inside reef. "Moins 6!" came the cry. It was already growing more shallow. Hunter turned again to look at Lazoo, high on the mainmast. Her body was leaning forward, relaxed, almost indifferent. He could not see her expression. Lazoo's body was indeed relaxed. It was so limp she was in danger of falling from her high post. Her arms gripped the top railing lightly as she leaned forward. Her shoulders were slumped, every muscle sagged. But her face was tight and pinched, her mouth pulled back into a fixed grimace. Her teeth clamped together as she squinted into the glare. She held her eyes nearly shut, and she had been doing this for so long that her eyelids fluttered with tension. This might have been distracting, but Lazoo was not even aware of it, for she had long ago slipped into a kind of trance state. Her world consisted of 2 black shapes, the island ahead and the bow of the ship just beneath her. Separating them was a flat expanse of shimmering, excruciatingly bright sunlit water, which fluttered and sparkled in a hypnotic pattern. She could see almost no detail in that surface. Occasionally, she had a glimpse of coral outcroppings awash. They appeared as brief black spots in the blinding white glare. At other times, during lulls in the gusting wind, she had a momentary image of eddies and currents, which swirled the uniform pattern of sparkles. Otherwise, the water was opaque, blinding silver. She guided the ship through this shimmering surface entirely by memory, for she had marked, In her mind, the position of shallow water, coral heads, and sandbars more than half an hour ago, when the ship was farther offshore and the water ahead was clear. She had made a detailed mental image using landmarks on the shore and in the water itself. Now, by looking directly down at the water passing amidships, which was transparent, she could gauge El Trinidad's position relative to her mental image. Far below, she saw a round head of brain coral, resembling a gargantuan clump of cauliflower, pass on the port side. She knew that meant they would have to bear north. She extended her right arm and watched as the black silhouette of the bow nosed around, and waited until they were in line with a dead palm tree on the shore. Then she dropped her hand. Enders held the new course. She squinted ahead. She saw the coral awash, marking the sides of the channel. They were bearing directly for the gap. From memory, she knew that before reaching the gap, they had to veer to starboard slightly to miss another coral head. She extended her right hand. Enders corrected. She looked straight down. The second coral head went past, dangerously close to the hull. The ship shivered as it scraped the outcropping, but then they were clear. She held out her left arm, and Enders changed course again. She lined herself on the dead palm again and waited. Enders had been electrified by the sound of the coral head on the hull. His nerves, straining to hear exactly that dreaded sound, were raw. He jumped at the tiller, but as the crunching continued, a vibration moving aft, he realized that they were going to kiss the coral, and he breathed a deep sigh. In the stern, he felt the vibration approaching him down the length of the ship. At the last moment, he released the tiller, knowing that the rudder was the most vulnerable part of the ship below water. A grazing collision that merely scraped the hull of barnacles could snap a hard-turned rudder, so he released tension. Then he took the tiller in his hand again and followed Lazoo's instructions. "She would break a snake's back," he muttered, as El Trinidad twisted and turned toward Monkey Bay. "Less four!" shouted the lineman. Hunter in the bow, flanked on either side by the men with their plumb lines, watched the glaring water ahead. He could see nothing at all forward. Looking to the side, he saw coral formations, fearsomely close to the surface. But somehow, El Trinidad was missing them.
"Trois et demi!"
He gritted his teeth. 20 feet of water. They could not take much less. As he had the thought, the ship struck another coral formation. But this time there was only a single sharp impact, then nothing. The ship had snapped the coral head, then continued on.
"Three and one!"
They had lost another foot. The ship plowed forward into the sparkling sea.
"Merde!"
yelled the second linesman, and started running aft. Hunter knew what had happened. His line had become snarled in coral and caught. He was trying to free it.
"Full three!"
Hunter frowned. They should be aground now, according to what his Spanish prisoners had told him. They had sworn El Trinidad drew 3 fathoms of water. Obviously, they were wrong. The ship still sailed smoothly toward the island. He silently damned Spanish seamanship. Yet he knew the 3-fathom draft could not be far wrong. A ship this size must draw very nearly that.
"Full three!"
They were still moving. And then, with frightening suddenness, he saw the gap in the reef, a desperately narrow passage between coral awash on both sides. El Trinidad was right in the center of the passage, and a damned fortunate thing, too, for there was no more than 5 yards to spare on either side as they passed through. He looked astern to Enders, who saw the coral on both sides of him. Enders was crossing himself.
"Full five!"
shouted the linesman hoarsely, and the crew gave a jubilant cheer. They were inside the reef, in deeper water, and moving north now to the protected cove between the island shore and the curving finger of hilly land, which encircled the seaward side of the bay. Hunter could now see the full extent of Monkey Bay. He could tell at a glance that it was not an ideal berth for his ships. The water was deep at the mouth of the bay, but it turned rapidly shallow in more protected areas. He would have to anchor the galleon in water that was exposed to the ocean, and for several reasons, he was unhappy with that prospect. Looking back, he saw the Cassandra make the passage safely. Following Hunter's ship so closely, he could see the worried expression on the linesman's face in Cassandra's bow. And behind the Cassandra was the Spanish warship, no more than 2 miles distant. But the sun was falling. The warship would not be able to enter Monkey Bay before nightfall. And if Bosquet chose to enter at dawn, then Hunter would be ready for him.
"Drop anchor!" Enders shouted. "Make fast!"
El Trinidad shuddered to a stop in the twilight. Cassandra glided past her, moving deeper into the bay. The smaller ship with her lesser draft could take the shoal water farther in. A moment later, Sanson's anchor splashed into the water, and both ships were secured. They were safe, at least for a time. Chapter 28. After the tension of the reef passage, the crews of both ships were jubilant, shouting and laughing, calling congratulations and mock insults to each other through the twilight. Hunter did not join in the general celebration. He stood on the aft castle of his galleon and watched the warship continue toward them, despite the rapidly growing darkness. The Spanish man of war was now within a half mile of the bay. She was just outside the reef entrance. Bosquet had great daring, he thought, to come so close in near darkness. He was also taking a considerable and unnecessary risk. Enders, also watching, asked the unspoken question, "Why?" Hunter shook his head. He saw the warship drop her anchor line. He saw the splash as it hit the water. The enemy vessel was so close he could hear the shouted commands in Spanish drifting to him across the water. There was a lot of activity in the stern of the ship. A second anchor was thrown out.
"Makes no sense," Enders said. "He's got miles of deep water to ride out the night, and he puts himself in 4 fathoms.
Hunter watched. Another stern anchor was thrown over the side, and many hands tugged at the line. The stern of the warship swung around toward the shore.
"Damn me," Enders said.
"You don't suppose?"
"I do," Hunter said. "She's lining up a broadside. Hoist anchor."
"Hoist anchor!" Enders shouted to his surprised crew. "Ready on the forsprit there. Lively with the lines."
He turned back to Hunter.
"We'll run aground for sure."
"We have no choice," Hunter said. Bosquet's intent was clear enough. He had anchored in the mouth of the bay, just beyond the reef, but within range of his broadside cannon. He intended to stay there and pound the galleon through the night. Unless Hunter moved out of range, risking the shallow water, his ships would be demolished by morning. And indeed, they could see the gun ports springing open on the Spanish warship, and the muzzles of the cannon as they were fired, the balls smashing through El Trinidad's rigging and splashing in the water around them.
"Get her moving, Mr. Enders," Hunter barked.
As if in answer, a second broadside blasted from the Spanish warship. This one was more on target. Several balls struck El Trinidad, splintering wood, tearing lines.
"Damn me,"
Enders said, with as much pain in his voice as if he had himself been injured. But Hunter's ship was moving now, and she inched out of range so that the next broadside fell harmlessly into the water in a straight line of splashes. That straightness was itself impressive.
"She's well manned," Enders said.
"There are times," Hunter said, "when you are too appreciative of good seamanship." By now it was quite dark. The fourth broadside came as a pattern of hot red flashes from the black profile of the warship. They heard, but could barely see, the splashes of shot in the water astern. And then the low offshore hilly curve obliterated the view of the enemy vessel.
"Drop anchor!"
Enders shouted, but it was too late. At that very moment, with a soft, crunching sound, El Trinidad ran aground on the sandy bottom of Monkey Bay. That night, sitting alone in his cabin, Hunter took stock of his situation. The fact that he was grounded did not bother him in the least. The ship had struck sand at low tide, and he could easily get her afloat in a few hours. For the moment, the two ships were safe. The harbor was not ideal, but it was serviceable enough. He had fresh water and provisions to last more than 2 weeks without subjecting his crew to any hardship. If they could find food and water ashore, and they probably could, then he could remain in Monkey Bay for months. At least he could remain until a storm came up. A storm could be disastrous. Monkey Bay was on the windward side of an ocean island, and its waters were shallow. A heavy storm would crush his ships to splinters in a matter of hours. And this was the season for hurricanes. He could not expect too many days to pass without experiencing one, and he could not remain in Monkey Bay when it struck. Bosquet would know this. If he were a patient man, he could simply blockade the bay, riding in deep water, and wait for the foul weather, which would force the galleon to leave the harbor and be exposed to his attack. Yet Bosquet did not seem to be a patient man. Quite the opposite. He gave every indication of resource and daring, a man who preferred to take the offensive when he could. And there were good reasons for him to attack before bad weather. In any naval engagement, foul weather was an equalizer, desired by the weaker force, avoided by the stronger. A storm plagued both ships, but it reduced the effectiveness of the superior ship disproportionately. Bosquet must know that Hunter's ships were short-handed and lightly armed. Sitting alone in his cabin, Hunter put himself in the mind of a man he had never met and tried to guess his thoughts. Bosquet would surely attack in the morning, he decided. That attack would either come from land or sea or both. It depended upon how many Spanish soldiers Bosquet had aboard and how well they trusted their commander. Hunter remembered the soldiers who had guarded him in the hold of the warship. They were young men, not experienced, poorly disciplined. They could not be relied upon. No, he decided. Bosquet would first attack from his ship. He would try to enter Monkey Bay until he was within view of the galleon. He probably suspected that the privateers were in shoal water, which would make maneuvering difficult. Right now, they were showing the enemy their stern, the most vulnerable part of the ship. Bosquet could sail just inside the mouth of the cove and fire broadsides until he sank both ships. And he could do that with impunity, because the treasure on the galleon would then lie in shallow water, where it could be salvaged from the sand by native divers. Hunter called for Enders and ordered that the Spanish prisoners be locked away safely. Then he ordered that every able-bodied privateer be armed with muskets and put ashore without delay. Dawn came gently to Monkey Bay. There was only a slight wind. The sky was laced with wispy clouds that caught the pink glow of first light. Aboard the Spanish warship, the crews began their morning's work in lazy and desultory fashion. The sun was well above the horizon before orders were shouted to let out the sails and raise anchor. At that moment, from all along the shore, on both sides of the passage to the bay, the concealed privateers opened with withering gunfire. It must have astounded the Spanish crews. In the first few moments, all the men winching the main anchor were killed. All the men hoisting the aft anchor were killed or wounded. The officers visible on the decks were shot, and the men in the rigging were picked off with astonishing accuracy and fell screaming to the deck. Then, just as abruptly, the firing ceased. Except for an acrid gray haze of powder hanging in the air on the shore, there was no sign of movement, no rustling of foliage, nothing. Hunter, positioned at the seaward tip of the hilly finger of land, watched the warship through his glass with satisfaction. He heard the confused shouts and watched the half-unreefed sails snap and flutter in the breeze. Several minutes passed before new crews began to climb the rigging and work the winches on deck. They began timidly at first, but when there was no further firing from the shore, grew bolder. Hunter waited. He had a distinct advantage, he knew. In an era when neither muskets nor musketeers were notably accurate, the privateers were, to a man, superb marksmen. His men could pick off sailors on the deck of a ship while giving chase in the rolling pitch of an open boat. To fire from the shore was child's play to his men. It was not even good sport. Hunter waited until he saw the anchor line beginning to move, and then he gave the signal to fire again. Another round poured onto the warship with the same devastating effect. Then another silence. Bosquet must surely realize by now that to enter the coral passage, coming closer to shore, would be extremely costly. He could probably make the passage and enter the bay, but dozens, perhaps hundreds of his men would be killed. Far more serious was the risk that key men aloft, or even the helmsman himself, might be shot, leaving the ship rudderless in dangerous waters. Hunter waited. He heard shouted commands, then more silence. And then he saw the main anchor line plop into the water. They had cut the anchor. A moment later, the stern lines were also cut, and the ship drifted slowly away from the reef. Once out of musket range, men again appeared on deck and in the rigging. The sails were let out. Hunter waited to see if she turned and made for the shore. The warship did not turn. Instead, she moved north perhaps 100 yards, and another anchor was dropped in the new position. The sails were taken up. The ship rode gently at anchor, directly off the hills, protecting the bay. "Well," Ender said, "that's it then. The Don can't get in, and we can't get out." By midday, Monkey Bay was burning hot and airless. Hunter, pacing the heated decks of his galleon, feeling the sticky ooze of softened pitch beneath his feet, was aware of the irony of his predicament. He had conducted the most daring privateering raid in a century with complete success, only to become trapped in a stifling, unhealthy cove by a single Donish ship of the line. It was a difficult moment for him, and even more difficult for his crew. The privateers looked to their captain for guidance and fresh plans, and it was all too obvious that Hunter had none. Someone broke into the rum, and the crew fell to brawling. One argument evolved into a duel. Enders stopped it at the last minute. Hunter passed the word that any man who killed another would himself be killed by Hunter. The captain wanted his crew intact, and personal disagreements could await landfall in Port Royal.
"Don't know if they'll stand for it," Enders said, gloomy as ever.
"They will," Hunter said. He was standing on deck in the shadow of the mainmast with Lady Sarah when another pistol shot rang out somewhere below decks.
"What's that?"
Lady Sarah said, alarmed.
"Hell," Hunter said.
A few moments later, a struggling seaman was brought above, in the grip of the enormous Bassa. Enders trailed disconsolately behind. Hunter looked at the seaman. He was a grizzled man of 25 named Lockwood. Hunter knew him slightly.
"Winged Perkins in the ear with this," Enders said, handing Hunter a pistol.
The crew was slowly filtering onto the main deck, surly and grim in the hot sun. Hunter took his own pistol from his belt and checked the prime.
"What are you going to do?"
said Lady Sarah, watching. "This is none of your concern," Hunter said.
"But—"
"Look away," Hunter said. He raised his pistol. Bassa, the Moor, released the seaman. The man stood there, head bowed, drunk.
"He crossed me," the seaman said.
Hunter shot him in the head. His brain spattered over the gunwale.
"Oh, God!"
said Lady Sarah Almont.
"Throw him overboard," Hunter said.
Bassa picked up the body and dragged it, feet scraping loudly in the midday silence on the deck. A moment later, there was a splash. The body was gone. Hunter looked at his crew.
"Do you want to vote a new captain?" he said loudly.
The crew grumbled and turned away. No one spoke. Soon after, the decks were cleared again. The men had gone below to escape the direct heat of the sun. Hunter looked at Lady Sarah. She said nothing, but her glance was accusing. "These are hard men," Hunter said, "and they live by rules we have all accepted." She said nothing, but turned on her heel and walked away. Hunter looked at Enders. Enders shrugged. Later in the afternoon, Hunter was informed by his lookouts that there was new activity aboard the warship. All the longboats had been lowered on the ocean side, out of view of the land. They were apparently tied up to the ship, for none had appeared. Considerable smoke was issuing from the deck of the warship. Some kind of fire was burning, but its purpose was unclear. This situation continued until nightfall. Nightfall was a blessing. In the cool evening air, Hunter paced the decks of El Trinidad, staring at the long rows of his cannon. He walked from one to the next, pausing to touch them, running his fingers over the bronze, which still held the warmth of the day. He examined the equipment neatly stowed by each, the rammer, the bags of powder, the shot clusters, the quill touchpins, and the slow fuses in the notched water buckets. It was all ready to use, all this firepower, all this armament. He had everything he needed except the men to fire them. And without the men, the cannon might as well not be there at all.
You are lost in thought.
He turned, startled. Lady Sarah was there, in a white shift. It looked like an undergarment in the darkness. You should not dress like that when the men about.
It was too hot to sleep, she said. Besides, I was restless. What I witnessed today.
Her voice trailed off. It disturbed you?
I have not seen such savagery, even in a monarch. Charles himself is not so ruthless, so arbitrary.
Charles has his mind on other things, his pleasures.
You deliberately miss my meaning.
Even in the darkness, her eyes glowed with something like anger. Madam, Hunter said, in this society...
Society? You call this?
She gestured with a sweeping hand to the ship and the men sleeping on the deck.
You call this society?
Of course. For wherever men gather, there are rules of conduct. These men have different rules from the court of Charles or of Louis, or even of Massachusetts Colony, where I was born. And yet there are rules to be upheld, and penalties to pay for breaking them.
You are a philosopher.
Her voice in the darkness was sarcastic. I speak what I know. In the court of Charles, what would befall you if you failed to bow before the monarch? She snorted, seeing the direction of his argument. It is the same here, Hunter said. These men are fierce and violent. If I am to rule them, they must obey me. If they are to obey me, they must respect me. If they are to respect me, they must recognize my authority, which is absolute.
You speak like a king.
A captain is king, over his crew. She moved closer to him.
And do you take your pleasure, as a king does?
He had only a moment to reflect before she threw her arms around him and kissed him on the mouth, hard. He returned her embrace. When they broke, she said,
I am so frightened. Everything is strange here.
Madam, he said, I am obliged to return you safely to your uncle and my friend, Governor Sir James Almont.
There is no need to be pompous. Are you a Puritan?
Only by birth, he said, and kissed her again.
Perhaps I will see you later, she said.
Perhaps. She went below with a final glance at him in the darkness. Hunter leaned on one of the cannon and watched her go.
Spicy one, isn't she?
He turned. It was Enders. He grinned. Get a well-born one across the line, and they start to itch, eh? So it appears, Hunter said. Enders looked down the row of cannon and slapped one with his hand. It rang dully.
Maddening, isn't it? He said.
All these guns, and we can't use 'em for lack of men. You'd best get sleep, Hunter said shortly, and walked off. But it was true, what Enders had said. As he continued pacing the decks, the woman was forgotten, and his thoughts returned to the cannon. Some restless part of his brain churned over the problem again and again, looking for a solution. Somehow he was convinced there was a way to use these guns. Something he had forgotten, something he knew long ago. The woman obviously thought he was a barbarian, or worse, a Puritan. He smiled in the darkness at the thought. In fact, Hunter was an educated man. He had been taught all the main categories of knowledge, as they had been defined since medieval days. He knew classical history, Latin and Greek, natural philosophy, religion, and music. At the time, none of it had interested him. Even as a young man, he was far more concerned with practical, empirical knowledge than he was in the opinions of some long-dead thinker. Every schoolboy knew that the world was much larger than Aristotle had ever dreamt. Hunter himself had been born on land that the Greeks did not know existed. Yet now, certain elements of his formal training tugged at his mind. He kept thinking of Greece, something about Greece or the Greeks, but he did not know what or why. Then he thought of the oil painting in Kazala's cabin aboard the Spanish warship. Hunter had hardly noticed it at the time, nor did he remember it clearly now, but there was something about a painting aboard a warship that intrigued him. In some way, it was important. What did it matter? He knew nothing of painting. He regarded it as a very minor talent, suitable only for decoration, and of interest only to those vain and wealthy noblemen who would pay to have their portraits done, with flattering improvements. The painters themselves were, he knew, trivial souls who wandered like gypsies from one country to another in search of some patron who would support their efforts. They were homeless, rootless, frivolous men who lacked the solid attachment of strong feeling for the nation of their birth. Hunter, despite the fact that his parents had fled England for Massachusetts, considered himself wholly English and passionately Protestant. He was at war with a Spanish and Catholic enemy and did not comprehend anyone who was not equally patriotic. To care only for painting, that was a pale allegiance indeed. And yet the painters wandered. There were Frenchmen in London, Greeks in Spain, and Italians everywhere. Even in times of war, the painters came and went freely, especially the Italians. There were so many Italians. Why did he care? He walked along the dark ship, passing from cannon to cannon. He touched one. Stamped on its postern was a motto, Semper Vincit. The words mocked him. Not always, he thought. Not without men to load and aim and fire. He touched the lettering, running his fingers over the grooves, feeling the fine, smooth curve of the S, the clean lines of the E. Semper Vincit. There was strength in the crispness of Latin, two tight words, military and hard. The Italians had lost all that. Italians were soft and flowery, and their tongue had changed to reflect the softness. It had been a long time since Caesar had bluntly said, Veni, Vidi, Vici. Vincit. That one word seemed to suggest something. He looked at the clean lines of the letters, and then in his mind he saw more lines, lines and angles, and he was back to the Greeks, to his Euclidean geometry, which had been so agonizing to him as a boy. He had never been able to understand why it mattered that two angles were equal to another, or that two lines intersected at one point or another. What difference did it make? Vincit. He remembered Kazala's painting, a work of art on a warship, out of place, serving no purpose. That was the trouble with art. It was not practical. Art conquered nothing. Vincit. It conquers. Hunter smiled at the irony of the motto, stamped into a cannon that would conquer nothing. This weapon was as worthless to him as Kazala's painting. It was as worthless to him as Euclid's postulates. He rubbed his tired eyes. All this thinking mattered not at all. He was traveling in circles with no sense, no purpose, no destination, only the persistent itch of a frustrated man who was trapped and sought an exit in vain. And then he heard the cry that seamen fear more than any other. Fire! Chapter 29. He rushed topside in time to see six fireboats bearing down on the galleon. They were the warship's longboats, thickly coated with pitch, and now blazing brightly, illuminating the still waters of the bay as they floated forward. He cursed himself for not anticipating this maneuver. The smoke on the warship's decks had been a clear clue, which Hunter had failed to understand. But he wasted no time in recrimination. Already the seamen of El Trinidad were pouring over the side into the galleon's longboats, tied alongside the ship. The first of the longboats cast off, the men stroking furiously toward the fireships. Hunter spun on his heel.
"Where are our lookouts?" he demanded of Enders. "How did this happen?"
Enders shook his head.
"I don't know. The watch was posted on the sandy point and the shore beyond."
Damn.
The men had either fallen asleep at their posts, or else Spaniards had swum ashore in the darkness, surprised the men, and killed them. He watched the first of his longboats, with its complement of seamen, battle the flames of one burning ship. They were trying to fend it off with their oars and to overturn it. One seaman caught fire and jumped screaming into the water. Then Hunter himself went over the side, dropping into a boat. As the crew rowed, they drenched themselves with seawater as they approached the burning boats. He looked off and saw that Sanson was leading a longboat from Cassandra to join the fight.
"Bend your backs, lads," Hunter shouted as he moved into the inferno. Even at a distance of 50 yards, the heat from the fireships was fierce. The flames streaked and jumped high into the night. Burning gobs of pitch crackled and spit in all directions, sizzling in the water. The next hour was a living nightmare. One by one, the burning ships were beached or held away in the water until their hulls burned out and they sank. When Hunter finally returned to his ship, covered in soot, his clothes ragged, he immediately fell into a deep sleep. Enders woke him the next morning with the news that Sanson was down in the hold of El Trinidad.
"He says he has found something," Enders said doubtfully.
Hunter pulled on his clothes and climbed down the four decks of El Trinidad to the hold. On the lowest deck, redolent of dung from the cattle above, he found Sanson, grinning broadly.
"It was an accident," Sanson said. "I cannot take credit. Come and see."
Sanson led the way below to the ballast compartment. This narrow, low passage stank of hot air and bilge water, which sloshed back and forth with the gentle motion of the boat. Hunter saw rocks placed there for ballast, and then he frowned. They were not rocks. They were too regular in shape. They were shot. He picked one up in his hand, hefting it, feeling the weight. It was iron, slippery with slime and bilge water.
5 pounds or so? Sanson said. "We have nothing on board to fire a 5-pound shot."
Still grinning, he led Hunter aft. By the light of a flickering lantern, Hunter saw another shape in the hold, half submerged by water. He recognized it immediately. It was a saker, a small cannon no longer much used on ships. Sakers had fallen out of popularity 30 years earlier, replaced either by small swivel guns or by very large cannons. He bent over the gun, running his hands along it, underwater.
"Will she fire?"
"She's bronze," Sanson said.
"The Jew says she will be serviceable."
Hunter felt the metal. Because it was bronze, it had not corroded much. He looked back at Sanson. "Then we will give the Don a taste of his own delights," he said. The saker, small though it was, still comprised 7 feet of solid bronze weighing 1,600 pounds. It took the better part of the morning to wrestle the gun onto El Trinidad's deck. Then the gun had to be lowered over to the side, to a waiting longboat. In the hot sun, the work was excruciating and had to be done with consummate delicacy. Enders shrieked orders and curses until he was hoarse, but finally the saker settled into the longboat as gently as if it were a feather. The longboat sank alarmingly under the weight, her gunwales clearing the water by no more than inches. Yet she was stable, as she was towed to the far shore. Hunter intended to set the saker on top of the hill that curved out from Monkey Bay. That would place it within range of the Spanish warship and allow it to fire on the offshore vessel. The gun emplacement would be safe. The Spaniards could not get enough elevation from their own cannon to make any reply, and Hunter's men could shell them until they ran out of balls. The real question was when to open fire. Hunter had no illusions about the strength of this cannon. A 5-pound shot was hardly formidable. It would take many rounds to cause significant damage. But if he opened fire at night, the Spanish warship might, in confusion, cast off and try to move out of range. And in shoal water at night, she could easily run aground or even sink. That was what he hoped for. The Saker, lying in the wallowing longboat, reached the shore, and 30 seamen groaned to haul it onto the beach. There it was placed on rollers and laboriously dragged, foot by foot, to the edge of the underbrush. From there, the Saker had to be pulled 100 feet up to the top of the hill, through dense clusters of mangrove and palm trees. Without winches or tackles to help with the weight, it was a forbidding job, yet his crew bent to the task with alacrity. Other men worked equally hard. The Jew supervised 5 men who scrubbed the rust from the iron shot and filled shot bags with gunpowder. The Moor, a skilled chandler, built a gun carriage with trunnion notches. By dusk, the gun was in position, overlooking the warship. Hunter waited until a few minutes before darkness closed in, and then he gave the order to fire. The first round was long, splashing on the seaward side of the Spanish vessel. The second round hit its mark, and so did the third. And then it